a lot of these problems of oral history relate to how you interpret what you hear, what you learn from it, and what you can document from some other source afterward. I shy very clear on some of these aspects of this because I've come across historians like Harvey Clare and others who have only one interest in mind. Identify those reds, and then you know what they were up to in this or that union. And the whole question is to prove an ostensible Communist Party grab for power. And I know how different that version is from real life. And how shallow that historical search for to validate somebody's Communist Party membership is. And so I have very negative reaction to it as a method of historiography or as a guide to intelligent research. That's really the basic. The two basic questions. There is this question, which is not a principal way to conduct history. And the other is that it leads to the subjective resistance and, at worst, to lies. Which then don't enlighten anybody very much. Bill was that unique individual whom there are not many in America, were not many, who stand out in the labor movement as effective mass labor leaders and identified communists. Don't raise the card, but there are very seldom any doubt about that. Archie Brown on the Frisco waterfront was such. Harry Mayville, the leader of the unemployment councils, of the Metal Workers Industrial Union, and of the organizing efforts, especially at the Ornamental Ironworks and the Ornamental Ironworkers strike, demonstrated those qualities. If you had a problem on the picket line, you sent out word to Harry Mayville and to Walter Frank and to Bill Mossop. And these three individuals would do the job. Well, you need 2,000 pickets and support 300 striking workers at Ornamental Ironworks to get them. You want to keep the company from moving the machinery out in the Struckler plant? Okay, you stop it. With Walter Frank and Bill Mossop. There's a different kind of an individual also emerging in this. It's a person like Swan Asserson.
Swan Asserson. Was he a Swede? Asserson?
Like Walter Frank, he was a late immigrant from Sweden. Uh-huh. He came to Minneapolis ostensibly to organize, or actually to organize, a Swedish workers' club. I never succeeded in that, but he saw the opportunity to organize the unskilled and lowest class of workers in the hotel and service trades, and he set about doing that. And he organized Local 665 almost single-handedly, although he went to the Bulgarian Macedonian Workers Club of George Namov, and recruited from there the support that he needed from Bulgarian Macedonians working in the athletic club. And it was the athletic club that cracked first. When you listen to the oral history interview with Dolly Stone, you will learn of the admiration that she had for Swan. Mm-hmm.
Swan. Yes, that's clear. No, I remember that.
Yeah.
There's very Swan little known about Swan.
Kind of a brotherly, almost comradely support. And Swan went around to young people. He himself was not very young. And he said, come and join Local 665, I need you. He recruited me for it. He probably recruited Ray Wright, who who were drifting around town, not doing anything special. I don't know if he recruited Bob Kelly, I think not. But he recruited Rosalind Madison, who was a student at the university, to come and become an organizer of the maids in the hotels. He had the most fantastic relationship with people. Nellie would describe him as talking philosophy. True. He was not flamboyant, he wasn't a mass speaker, probably even a boring speaker. But one of the more effective labor organizers I've ever encountered, from the point of view of an approach to rank and file unionism. Whatever else Local 665 was, it grew up to about 4,000 members, totally ignored by the hotel trade union before, and built it into a progressive rank and file union. We didn't have to educate George Melbourne. George was a socialist 50 years before that. He didn't have to educate Ray Wright. He had become a radical up in the Upper Peninsula, Michigan. I've been organizing farmers in Wisconsin before I came here. I worked on the railroads and mines and the lumber camps. Probably had something to do with the figurehead boys, I'm not sure. But I know he dragged Ole into that union for a while and made him an organizer. You deal with types, living people, and it's hard in all this to identify any single relationship of people to the party or to the union. This kind of situation makes it kind of irrelevant about, say, Nellie Stone's membership in the CP. I have no evidence that she ever had a party card, Nellie speaks openly about SWAG, about her constructive work that the communists did, and the significance of events like this one she spoke at, which she remembers very well. So I can only give you complicated answers to simple questions. But respect to oral history, as I said, I think that those are some of the elements that enter into it.
Well, I'm glad you gave me this answer.
I know that you run into what seem like endless irrelevances sometimes in this business. I don't know if it's particularly true of the elderly or not. But
No. I don't think that's the issue. I think the issue is for the younger generation and the people that didn't experience it directly to understand the context.
Yeah.
When you tell me what you've told me about the first interview you were talking about, the name escapes me at the moment because I'm
Anthony
bad with
Cassius Brutus.
Yes, yes.
Right.
And that him going over to talk to Bob Kelly was the connection. That's how he saw communism. Communism for him was Bob Kelly. Okay. Right. Nobody can understand that from reading that interview unless they know that connection.
No, you'll get more light on the subject by asking Bob Kelly.
Sure. But you see, for me reading the interview, and I'm sure for Peter reading the interview, we couldn't figure that out. You know?
Yeah.
It's not that it's irrelevant, it's just that we don't understand the context. Because all the historians we've read have tried to label people as, you're not a communist unless you're carrying a card. You know what I'm saying? And I know that stuff is meaningless from my own research.
Yeah.
But it's a hard problem.
Cassius, yeah, Cassius, by the remotest touch of imagination, would never be thought of as a Marxist. And yet I think in the category of black radicals, he's got to be enumerated there. I don't know quite how to define that black radical historically. I can tell you about bill in the land district.
Uh-huh.
That doesn't describe the more complex situation.
See, I could go back through those interviews right now and read them, and they would have a complete, they would be complete, it would be like reading things completely different.
Do you think so?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Uh-huh. Absolutely, yeah. Because, I mean, the thing you're talking about is like, there were plenty of hobos that never heard of Karl Marx that were IWWs,
sure,
that carried red cards, but they didn't understand. They never read the preamble. So how did they become wobblies? Why were they wobblies? Well, that's a good question. I can't give you a simple answer to that either.
Well, you know, Paul Beale in that interview gives us some interesting clues to that. How to look at that question. He makes a very interesting point that the greatest influence was at the periphery.
Yes, yes.
Well, that's true and not true. It's one of those complicated truths. There must be a periphery to be a master.
Yes.
It distinguishes a clique, a sect, from an effective leadership of sect.
Yeah, that's a very interesting observation that he made, definitely. And that's, interestingly enough, that's what Frank said about himself. He said, I was a person that was at the periphery. I wasn't really at the core of what was happening. And there were a lot of ways in which he felt that, you know, he didn't have anything to say because of that, because he was like a rank and file guy, you know. He was a worker and he was an artist. And therefore, you know, no one ever gave him institutional recognition. So therefore, his experience is not meaningful or something. Do you want to grab lunch?
So,
I
you
see
know,
you looking at your clock.
When you have it, a Communist Party State Executive Board composed of Nat Ross, Martin Young, Bill Moses, Harry Mabel, also of what's Frank's brother's name? Steve Adams, a worker, shop worker. Biggest industrial plant in Minnesota. Biggest one asks him, what do you got? You got a state executive really connected with events. So you go to the state convention, 1936 convention of the Farmer Labor Party. The left-wing floor leadership is headed by Bill Moses, Mary Lasseur, eloquent orators, relatively coherent in their political strategies, relatively close to the centralized kind of left leadership that the party represents. How do you have strength? I don't know if Swan was a member of the party board at that time. Pick a party board a little later, because Bob Kelly and Swan Atchison and Ed Kelly, who was the organizer of the public workers, the first one, and Bill Moses. Harry Mabel was probably still there too. You have a party organization. Flawless weaknesses could carry a lot of political clout and could talk to a lot of people in the FLCW. Bill Nat used to play poker with a group, including Sandy Jennings, who was the founder of the CIO. I don't know who the others were up there.
So yeah, they did place communists in very key positions, mm-hmm. state secretaries, people here and there in the front of the labor movement. I got a conference with all the Wall Street leaders now and then. You had a politics that didn't do a great deal for creating a mass Marxist socialist movement, but had a lot to do with creating an effective lifestyle and a movement. Given the concept of the political party that originated with Lenin, and it was codified by the Communist International, it was extremely difficult for that party to break out from those patterns into new directions. When it did break out into a bold new direction to dissolve the Communist Party and form the Communist Political Association, which was then nonpartisan, this was stopped short. The most innovative step that the Communist Party ever took. Many of my friends still condemn it as having been un-Marxist or something. Weird. You know, that right winger, Johnny Gage, thinks the broader period was a disaster. I may be wrong. That used to be his position.
Yeah, so does Sam. I mean, Sam feels it is a disaster, yeah. Too.
So Sam is a guy who, ostensibly at least, says he came here to try to get the Communist Party to break with this narrowness and come out in the open and bring his message to the people. What's his quarrel with Browder? How did the loser the purity of Marxism-Leninism, obviously? Sure he did. About time.
Yeah.
That's enough.
Okay. All right.